Is there hope for people who have undiagnosed diseases?
Does sexual harassment or assault affect women's mental or physical health?
Can statins be used for anything besides cardiovascular disease prevention?
And optimizing the immunization of newborns against whooping cough.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed Double T, your weekly look at the medical headlines from Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso. I'm Elizabeth Tracy, a medical journalist at Johns Hopkins, and this will be posted on October 12, 2018.
And I'm Rick Lang, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, since it's so very timely, I think we should turn first to JAMA Internal Medicine. This was a study taking a look at the impact of sexual harassment and assault on women, specifically on their mental health, sometime later.
As you said, this is pretty timely. It's been estimated that in the United States, between 40 and 75% of women have experienced workplace sexual harassment, and actually one in three may have experienced sexual assault. What this study did was it tried to establish, was there an association of sexual harassment and sexual assault with midlife women's mental and physical health? And they did that by surveying 304 women that were otherwise healthy. They were not smoking, they had no cardiovascular disease. Their mean age was about 54 years, and asked them, have you ever experienced sexual harassment at work that was either physical or verbal, or had they experienced sexual assault? Had they been made or pressured into having some type of unwanted sexual contact? And then they looked at their physical and mental outcomes. And among those 304 women, about 20% reported a history of workplace sexual harassment, and 22% reported a history of sexual assault. The women who reported sexual assault had a 2 to 3-fold higher incidence of clinical depressive symptoms, anxiety, and poor sleep. Those that had experienced sexual harassment also were more likely to experience poor sleep, and also about 2.5 times more likely to experience hypertension.
I guess some of these associations are not really terribly surprising. I think the 1 in 5 figure, basically, that this study comes up with is interesting. And of course, that's only relative to the workplace. It's not relative to other places.
Right. So, Elizabeth, as you mentioned, this is lower than many other estimates. Second of all, this is an association at best. It took women that had experienced these behaviors and those that didn't and said, was there an association with mental and physical health? But it doesn't prove it's causative at all. But obviously, it puts it out there. We want to avoid these behaviors regardless.
And I, at least, applaud the investigators for stepping into this place. This is clearly a very tough place right now. But I think more kinds of studies that attempt to really assess the magnitude of the problem and, of course, ultimately come up with solutions are going to be the kind of things we'd like to see.
Yep, it's timely now because of the news, but studies like this were submitted to the journal months ago. It's kind of fortuitous that we're reporting it this week in light of everything we've been hearing on the news.
My last question about this is, I know that there are attempts right now in primary care practices to ask women about, especially whether they feel safe at home, if there might be problems that are going on. Would you expand that to workplace as well?
Absolutely, Elizabeth. I think that's a very good point. Oftentimes we don't ask about this either at home or specifically in the workplace.
Okay. Let's turn from here to the New England Journal of Medicine, one for which we do not have the complete data yet, but which piques both of our interest, which I think is why we're going to cover it. That's a report from the Undiagnosed Diseases Network, which we didn't even know existed until we took a look at this particular report. Turns out that that was formed in 2014 as a network of 7 clinical sites, 2 sequencing cores, and a coordinating center, and also a biorepository, a metabolomics core, and a model organisms screening center were added. It sounds like an awful lot of infrastructure for something we're not even familiar with. They took a look at patients who were referred to this center over a period of 20 months. Those referrals totaled 1,519 patients, 53% of whom were female. Of those, 601, or 40%, were accepted for evaluation. So that's interesting, and I'd like to know a little more about what is the criteria for acceptance in order to take a look at that. Of those accepted patients, they had a lot of stuff done before they actually turned up at this center, but clearly they were still struggling to figure out, well, what is it I have? And over that time, this center, UDN, was able to establish a diagnosis in 35% of the folks they accepted. which is pretty powerful, I think, for people who have been struggling, and we're both familiar with this, with having a syndrome, something going on for which no practitioner seems able to really put their finger on it. It does make me wonder what happened to the other two-thirds. And they also report that they identified new syndromes in 31 of these people.
They started with about 1,500 patients. They accepted 600, and only 382 had the complete evaluation. And that complete evaluation included not only the history and physical, but also the genetic information and the metabolic information. What this UDN is supposed to do, it's promoting the use of genomic data in diagnosing diseases and engaging the basic researchers to help establish what the mechanisms are that underlie these diseases so we can identify treatments. Ultimately, they'll also use this program to train clinicians in the use of contemporary genomic approaches. I think this is pretty neat. We'll look forward to getting all the complete information. I would like to note that of these undiagnosed conditions, 40% of them were neurologic. I'm interested in knowing why that particular group of individuals, it was particularly difficult to make the diagnosis without these additional tests.
Very interesting. I think that it gets a lot more powerful as these huge data sets also are put together. Let's move from here to the Journal of the American Medical Association. Vaccinating women while they're pregnant, how does that impact on the health of the newborn, especially with regard to whooping cough?
Whooping cough, or pertussis, the incidence is highest in kids between the time they're born and the time they receive their first vaccination, which is 6 months of age. How do we cover the kids in? Because if they get whooping cough during that time period, that actually has the highest mortality. Well, it's recommended that women get immunization with what's called Tdap, that's tetanus, diphtheria, and acellular pertussis, that vaccine, somewhere in the third trimester of pregnancy. What this study did was take 626 women who were pregnant, about half of whom had immunization during the time prescribed and half didn't, and actually measured the antibodies in the cord blood of the neonate. Compared to those women that weren't immunized, those that received the vaccination had much higher antibody levels. They were about 3.5 times higher. And we know that the higher the antibody level, the more protective it is. Those women who got immunized between weeks 27 and 30 had the highest cord level of antibodies versus those that got their immunization between the weeks 30 to 36. So if you want to optimize the antibody level in your newborn, it appears that the best time to do it is early in the third trimester rather than later.
I think this is really valuable information because we know those maternal antibodies are just so very important. And I'm wondering about the further study of things like the flu vaccine, for example, and how protective that might be, depending on the timing.
Yep. It's interesting. What happens is the mother has to make antibodies, and those antibodies have to make it across the placenta into the baby. That passage is very dynamic. It appears that the passage of antibodies is maximal between about 32 to 34 weeks. Now, it takes a couple weeks for the mother to make antibodies once she gets the vaccine. Different vaccines have different size antibodies, and they may pass through the placenta at different rates, but we ought to be able to model that and predict on the basis of that when the optimal time during third trimester it is to administer these vaccinations.
So let's turn to our final one. That's in Annals of Internal Medicine. This was a comprehensive look at all the data that's out there in peer-reviewed studies and randomized clinical trials regarding the use of statins. Comprehensive, as I said, so pretty big data set, taking a look at all of that out there. And there's been a lot of tantalizing information that we've talked about in the past about, gosh, is there an impact of statins on dementia risk, for example, or on other cancer risks? And this study took a look at all of that and basically said, and I'm going to let you expand on this data a little bit because you're such a data nerd, basically said, for right now, folks, statins, they really are useful in cardiovascular disease prevention, but not in everything else.
Because of the non-cholesterol-lowering properties, anti-inflammatory properties, for example, there was some thought that statins could be useful for a number of non-cardiovascular diseases. And this particular study looked at over 278 non-cardiovascular diseases. And I'll quote, "They report a dearth of convincing evidence that statins had a major role in the outcomes of these non-cardiovascular diseases." Now, there were a couple exceptions. There were a couple studies that were highly suggestive that people that were on statins, once they had a diagnosis of cancer, it improved their survival a bit. And for people that had COPD and exacerbations, it would lower the risk. And everything else, not very convincing.
I still recall a time when we were quipping about, goodness, are we going to be putting statins in the drinking water because they appear to be so global in their benefits. I am glad about this study that there's some more definition of that posture.
There are over 40 million individuals in the U.S. already taking statins. So I agree with you. We want to target the medical therapy to what we know is appropriate and evidence-based. We want to avoid it when there's really no substantial benefit to it.
On that note, I'm going to talk about the undiagnosed diseases from NEJM on the blog this week. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Texas Tech. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all listen up and make healthy choices.